If you haven't got a drink, grab one. We're going to be talking about the moon and Mars for about the next 25 minutes, and you'll be welcome to take part in that as well. And this comes, this is the interesting bit. This is when I do the introduction of the guest. I've had a chance to look at this guy's bio. If you haven't, it'll blow your mind. I'm just going to read a small bit. I would have sort of done this from memory, but there's too much of it. So how about this? He's from New Mexico. NM is still New Mexico, isn't it? Yes, Silver City, New Mexico. Harrison Hagen Schmidt, geologist, pilot, astronaut, administrator, businessman, writer, US senator. BS in science from Caltech, Fulbright scholar in Oslo, grad school at Harvard, PhD in geology. Based on geological field studies in Norway, he received his Air Force jet pilot wings in 1965, his Navy helicopter wings in 1967, and after that, what do you do? Well, you go into the US Senate, where he's been heavily involved in legislating and administering things to do with science and space, as well as, of course, issues inherent to New Mexico and other things. Look, make him welcome, Harrison Hagen Schmidt, our guest for today.
Thank you.
Now, sorry, I just did a little bit of research. Is it 9 or 12 people who are on the moon? I've seen two different numbers.
There were 12 originally. 9 are still alive.
Okay.
So you've got both numbers correct.
And were you the last or the second last to walk there?
I was the 12th person to step on the moon.
Okay.
I actually got off before Gene Cernan did, so he would gain the credit, I guess, of being the last person to get off the moon, but I was the 12th to get on it.
And I know you told one of my colleagues, Kerry O'Brien, earlier this week that it's something you still think about because people are always asking you to think about it. We'll probably ask you to do it again today.
Well, that's been one of the delightful parts of the last 30 years, that people seem to always stay interested in hearing about my experiences and what we learned and what we may do next.
Let's talk about what happened then in 1972. It was the final mission. Did you know it was going to be the final mission?
We actually were aware that the missions beyond Apollo 17 had been canceled beginning about early 1970. Various decisions were made both by the administration and by NASA. The Nixon administration and by NASA to begin to pull back from the Apollo commitment. The original funding for Apollo contained the provisions for building, which were done, building about 5 more rockets and spacecraft than we actually used to go to the moon. Some of those were used for the Skylab program in the mid-1970s, some of you may be aware of, the first space station program, really, of the Earth. And unfortunately, 3 of the rockets are lying on their sides as museum pieces now.
I think I've seen them. They're not rusting, so that's good. They're still being
looked after. Well, it's hard to say what's happening to them. One in Florida is particularly in good shape because it's now been put under cover, although it did sit outside for about 25 years. The decisions probably were unfortunate, I think, in the wrong reach of history, not continuing to utilize the Apollo capability of going into deep space, particularly the large rockets, would be termed a mistake. But you also have to look at it in the eyes of the politicians and others at the time, particularly the news media. The news media had sort of gotten bored with going to the moon, and unfortunately, sometimes that happens. Things that are continuously positive are difficult to cover, I guess, and we just have to learn to deal with that. More importantly, the United States and indeed many other countries were deeply involved in Vietnam. There were other issues coming up politically relative to retirement and health security. And the Nixon administration just decided not to keep asking for the resources to use the hardware that had already been bought. It costs just about as much to use it as it did to build it, so they saved some money there, I guess. But you still have to wonder about that decision to not at least run out the use of the vehicles that were were already available. However, in the really long reach of history, 30 years, probably more like 40 years now, before we return to deep space, will probably not turn out to be as nearly as significant as the Apollo program itself was to history. Human beings, I think, humankind is pretty well committed now to heading into deep space at some time in the not-too-distant future, going back and probably going back to stay. Certainly the resources are available on the moon to support human settlements. They clearly are available on Mars. And I just do not think that if you look at human beings really as a biological species, that we will wait too much longer before we're actually going forward into space and planning to stay there.
I'm going to be turning it over to you for some questions shortly, but I'll just pick up on this one, if I may, and that's the question of resources. I mean, I've seen a couple of statements from you which say that there are all the resources that are needed on Mars and on the Moon to sustain human habitation. Now, let's just take the Moon. It certainly doesn't look like it from here.
Well, they're not... I think you said ore or oil? Ore.
All.
Yes. Well, the primary resource... I think can take us back to the moon commercially is an energy resource. It's a light isotope of helium called helium-3 that is a nearly ideal fuel theoretically for fusion power. When you fuse,
so fusion power, for those who don't know, which is me, nuclear fusion
power is the combining of atoms versus fission power, which we're familiar with here on Earth now. France, I think, is almost 80% now producing its electrical power with nuclear fission reactors. Fission power is the splitting of atoms to gain energy. Fusion is somewhat more difficult. It's combining of atoms, but clearly, theoretically, we know a lot about it, and experimentally, there's been a fair amount of progress. The Joint European Torus reactor, a fusion reactor in Great Britain, has set some significant milestones in fusion using two isotopes of hydrogen, deuterium and tritium. That fusion process is well known. It's relatively easy compared to using helium-3. And we have learned a great deal scientifically about what we call plasmas, because of the research going on in that particular style of fusion. However, it has become very apparent to many, at least those outside of governments, that the commercialization of a deuterium-tritium fusion power cycle is going to be very difficult, probably impossible. It's just very, very expensive. They require the use of extraordinarily large magnets. You have to build very, very large machines to get to break even, and to actually produce more power than you put in. And that is really what led my colleagues at the University of Wisconsin to start to explore alternatives, and one of those alternatives turned out to be discovery by them that the geologists and geochemists who had been studying the moon had found this isotope helium-3 in the lunar soils at significant concentrations. Just to give you some perspective on why one might be interested, a metric ton of helium-3 at today's prices, crude oil prices, has the energy equivalent of about $5 billion worth of crude oil. So a metric ton of helium-3 and $5 billion worth of crude oil have about the same amount of energy in them.
That's billion with a B.
That's with a B. That's right. And that's U.S. dollars, by the way. Sorry.
The real ones.
Yeah. And, well, not necessarily real dollars, but that's what my mind works in right now.
Just one thing before I turn it over to you. Have you noticed this? He's the first American I've seen walk into a pub and ask for a Guinness. Where'd that come from?
Well, it came out of a barrel, I think. No, I have always, for a long time, thought very highly of Guinness and stouts in general, and that's what I like to have.
All credit to you. All right, who's first? Who wants to go? Yell it out nice and loud. Don't have to put your hand up. Anyone like to talk to Harrison? Could be anything. What did the moon look like when you stepped out of the pod? How can I find out more about fission power, fusion power, whatever it is? Yeah.
I should point out for those who don't know that Harrison is described as being the first scientist to go on the moon. The rest of them were Buzz Lightyears, apparently, but you were the first scientist.
Well, I was the first professional scientist with a significant amount of experience in geology before I was selected as an astronaut. And a number of other scientists were selected at the same time, but I happened to be the only geologist, and so it was probably going to be fairly certain that if any scientist went to the moon in the Apollo program, it would be I. However, you have to realize that we accomplished a great deal of science by training the test pilots as sort of field geological assistants. Until I was able to go, that's really the way they operated, and we had a very extensive training program, particularly beginning with Apollo 13.
It's not the same as having a scientist there, though, is it?
No, it's not. It's the same as if somebody plucked me out of geology and said, go test that airplane. You know, I wouldn't know very much about it, and I wouldn't have an experience base to do it, and it would take a long time for me to develop that experience base. When you have certain jobs to do anywhere, and particularly in space, It's I think, now clear that you take the people who are professionally qualified to do that job, give them the other skills they need in order to operate safely and reliably in space, but take advantage of their professional experience and training. And I think as a result of the initial scientist-astronaut group, the six of us, all the rest of whom, except for one, flew in the Skylab program, that now that's a fairly, that's understood. The space shuttle program, now the space station activities do include the presence of payload specialists, mission specialists, which is just a euphemism for scientists and engineers and other physicians and others who can bring their experience to bear on those kinds of tasks. Whether or not having more scientists would have helped in gaining the public's interest, I don't know. Again, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but the only form of continuing education that we really have in the United States is the media, the national media, and the vast majority of the electorate get their information from the media. And if the media loses interest in something, for whatever reason that is, then the public's not gaining interest. The surveys continued to show in those days and subsequently that there's been a continuous, fairly significant majority interest in continuing space activities. It's just that without that interest that will drive the political side of the spectrum, space fell away from the national agenda. Yeah, and you also have to remember that it was not science that drove the Apollo program. It was a political agenda that drove it. And to the credit of a significant number of NASA managers, particularly people like George Lowe and Sam Phillips and others, we did develop the capability well before the Apollo 11 mission ever landed on the moon to perform significant science on the moon. Consequence of that was that the six landings that did occur on the moon gave us the foundations for an extremely detailed understanding of the origin and evolution of the moon, understanding that relates directly to the early evolution of the Earth as a planet, and particularly to the environment that existed in the solar system at the time life was evolving here on Earth. So if you want to put Apollo down as a scientific success, I think you can. It was a remarkable success. Could it have been better? Of course it could have been better, but you have to remember the context in which it was all being done. It was a program not designed initially to do any science, and a great deal was done as a consequence of what we did put together.
It's an interesting problem that you have, that you're continually having to deal with the public's demand for the new. You talked before about the media becoming really pretty bored with the good news, pretty bored. And we're going to the moon, fantastic. I mean, when was the last time anyone got up to watch a space shuttle take off? I think that probably the last time I was the disaster, and I certainly didn't feel like doing it after that. But the space shuttles go up, space shuttles come down, no one's really that interested anymore. You've got the International Space Station. Well, I mean, people
really... I think the challenge, and those of you who are interested in science communications, face that challenge every day or every time you try to write something. The challenge is to take what is being learned, which is new all the time, and there's fascinating stuff going on, and put it into a form in which the public can be both educated and interested simultaneously. It's a real challenge, and the vast majority of news reporters aren't really interested in that challenge. I'm sorry. That's just been my experience. But you all represent a very unique group of people because you are interested.